This is a special bonus episode of the Sala Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, April 4, 2021. I am the Sala Monster. This is a special WrestleMania edition of This Week in Wrestling History. You know, when I saw that there were over 20 WrestleManias this week in history, I wanted to cry. And then I smacked myself in the face and I said, quit whining and get back to work. And so this week is dedicated to some of the biggest WrestleManias of all time. And some not so big ones. And there may be a few stories worked in here that you've never heard before. And so we begin with the most important WrestleMania of all time. The very first one, which took place 36 years ago this week on March 31st, 1985. The year Marty McFly was from. At Madison Square Garden in New York City, my father and his father were in attendance that night. I still have the original WrestleMania logo t-shirt they bought me, which is a size small. And so if I tried to wear it now, it would basically be a bra or a man's ear, if you're a Seinfeld fan. But I do still have it. Vince McMahon's national expansion was in full effect. There was a chance meeting on a flight the year prior with Captain Lou Albano and Cyndi Lauper that got her involved with the company as part of the whole rock and wrestling connection. Mr. T, he was involved, right? He was one of the most famous TV stars of that era from the A-Team. He would team up with Hulk Hogan in the main event of this show. They brought in other celebrities like Liberace as the guest timekeeper. They had former Yankees manager Billy Martin as the guest ring announcer for the main event. Muhammad Ali was supposed to be the referee for the main event, ended up being the outside enforcer. Pat Patterson had said years ago on a Legends Roundtable that Ali's Parkinson's disease was starting to cause him some problems, which is why, or at least one of the reasons why they swapped him out of the ring and had Patterson as the referee during that main event. Now, I've also heard they had concerns about what Mr. T may or may not do during the match. There were a lot of questions about things that might happen in that main event, and so they just wanted somebody they could trust who knew what was going on and knew how to, you know, mitigate the situation. So, you know, that's why Patterson was in the match. Whatever the reason, Vince McMahon put everything on the line with this show. It was go big or go home. Tito Santana years ago said Vince rallied the troops before the show and said that it was either going to make them or it was going to break them. He had a lot invested in this. If it didn't work, he probably would have gone bankrupt, which is what happened to he and his wife Linda once before. They had their house auctioned off many years ago. Linda's car was repossessed right out of their driveway. This would have been around the time Stephanie, she was pregnant rather with Stephanie. So they didn't want that to happen again. They had been down that road before, bankruptcy. They didn't want to go through that again. They got a letter of credit from a bank to help finance the show. And it was a success. It was seen by over a million people on closed circuit TV. Got the major publicity all over the country. In fact, Hulk Hogan and Mr. T hosted Saturday Night Live on NBC the night before. It was also, of course, the incident on Richard Belzer's old TV show. I don't remember what the name of the show was. Richard Belzer was a comedian. He was an actor. You know, he was on Law & Order for a number of years. But he had a television talk show back then, and Hogan and Mr. T were on as guests to promote WrestleMania. And I think Belzer wanted Hogan to put him in some kind of a wrestling hole just to demonstrate. And so he put Belzer, Hogan did, in a front face lock and put him out. And he went to go let go of him, maybe not realizing he was unconscious. And Belzer just fell to the floor. His head cracked and hit the floor. He sued. I think it went all the way to the New York Supreme Court before it was settled out of court. He got a big settlement out of it. But those who were remember that time, Hogan and Mr. T were everywhere. They were on the morning shows. I mean, WWE got their money's worth as far as the publicity out of Mr. T as part of this show. Now, this show got its name, depending on who you believe, either from Howard Finkel or from George Scott, who was a booker at the time for WWE. George Scott claimed that he came up with the idea. He came up with the name. Finkel once told Slam Wrestling that he was the one who came up with the idea when he brought up the Beatles. When the Beatles came to America, there was this whole Beatlemania phenomenon that swept the country. And so he asked the question, I guess in a meeting with McMahon and everybody else, he just goes, well, there was a Beatlemania, how come there can't be a WrestleMania? And the rest is history. And thank God it was, because the name Vince McMahon wanted to go with for this first big event was the Colossal Tussle, which just doesn't have the same ring to it. If you try to think of Shawn Michaels calling himself Mr. Colossal Tussle, I don't know, it just doesn't roll off the tongue quite as well. But King Kong Bundy pinned Special Delivery Jones in what they claimed was a record-setting 9 seconds, which actually was closer to 24 seconds. I mean, I've heard of exaggerations in wrestling, but this is ridiculous. Andre the Giant beat Big John Studd in a $15,000 body slam challenge. Wendy Richter, with Cyndi Lauper in her corner, won the women's championship from Leilani Kai. And the Babyfaces got the win in the main event with Hulk Hogan and Mr. T beating Roddy Piper and Paul Orndorff, who took an errant shot from Cowboy Bob Orton in the cast on his arm. Linda McMahon got a call about 3 o'clock in the morning after the event, once all of the closed circuit receipts were in from around the country, letting her know that it did well enough that they just broke even. So they didn't have to worry about the bank coming after them. 34 years ago this week, on March 29th, 1987, the most iconic WrestleMania of all time, although I know some might say that belongs to number 17, WrestleMania 3 was held at the Pontiac Silverdome before a reported crowd of 93,173 fans. WWE had the pay-per-view blacked out on all cable systems in the state of Michigan as a way to kind of drive people to have to physically buy a ticket and come to the Silverdome if they wanted to see the show. That number has been disputed now for a number of years, the attendance figure, by Dave Meltzer, who reported, for many years, Meltzer reported that same 93,173 figure in the Observer. He just took it at face value and he reported it in his newsletter for years, until sometime in the mid-90s, he was having a phone conversation with Zane Breslov, who he was, you know, very friendly with at that time. Zane Breslov was a promoter. He was handling the local promotion, or his company was handling the local promotions for WrestleMania 3. And Breslov, he was doing work with WWE for a while. Eventually, he went to go do similar types of work with WCW. He was very good. He was very good, very effective at his job. I mean, he was doing stuff with WCW right on through the Monday Night War period. But he was having a conversation with Meltzer. And he was surprised that Dave still bought the attendance figure as real. So Dave claims that he faxed him. He faxed Meltzer the ticket accounting paperwork that he had a record of. And that paperwork showed a figure of 78,500. The only problem is, Meltzer never held on to a copy of the fax, or if he did, it was lost in history. I mean, have you seen photos of Meltzer's home office? I'm amazed he can find anything in there. I'm amazed his whole fucking house hasn't burned down with all the freaking papers that are laying all over the place. But it's all moot anyway, because it was only a few months after WrestleMania that year, claiming the indoor attendance record at the Silverdome, that Pope John Paul II held mass at the Silverdome and beat them by a few hundred people. Roddy Piper beat Adrian Adonis in a hair versus hair match that doubled as Piper's retirement match as he was leaving to try a career in Hollywood. He's going to be filming John Carpenter's movie They Live. Piper said that he learned very early in his career, you leave a territory when it almost peaks, not when it peaks. Then it's a bigger deal when you eventually come back, which of course he did, because they all do. We had Randy Savage against Ricky the Dragon Steamboat for the Intercontinental Championship. Savage meticulously mapped out this match on a yellow legal pad, step by step, to go over with Steamboat, who told ESPN that it got into something like 100-something steps that Savage had mapped out for this match. This is what he said. He said, finally, when we got the match top to bottom, we would meet up and quiz ourselves. And I would say, okay, I'm at step number 50, 55, he goes, and it's this and this, and now tell me the rest of the match. And Savage would go, well, step number 56 is this, and step number 57 is that. We would go back and forth, he said. And understandably, Steamboat was very stressed out, having to remember everything. It's not the way that he usually worked his matches. You know, he, like a lot of guys back then, would call their matches on the fly. And I mean, Savage could do the same. It's not like Savage had to map out every single match he ever had. But Savage clearly wanted to go out there and steal the show and have the best possible match they could have. And he just had this vision in his brain of what this match was going to look like. And he forced Steamboat to have to memorize it spot by spot, move by move. You know, you'd be driven crazy too, you know, if you were in Steamboat's position. George the Animal Steel got sick of hearing them talk about the damn match for weeks on end because he was an old school guy. He didn't plan his matches out. And he hated not being in the match because apparently the show was only about 18 miles away from his house. And he wanted to do more than just stand in somebody's corner. He wanted to be in the ring and have a match. But instead, he was relegated to Steamboat's corner for the match. And look, the match, it was a classic. But if you watch it back by today's standards, it's a fairly basic match. Nothing wrong with it. It's a very good match. But it is a fairly basic match. The thing is that everything they did was so crisp. And it made sense. And even with all the false finishes, which was virtually unheard of at that time, they didn't overdo them like you see so often today. You know, the one thing that Steamboat years ago told Wrestling Inc. was that if he had the ability to go back in time and do anything over or add anything to the match, the one thing he would have added, he would have come off the top rope with his dive. I guess it was like a crossbody, which was his finish at the time. And he would have gotten a two count before Savage kicked out. Just to throw a little curveball to the fans. He said back then you didn't prostitute your finish. But he thinks it would have worked. Lanny Poffo says the match, in a way, ruined his brother's life because he was never satisfied about anything. Everybody would go around saying, oh, it's the greatest match I've ever seen. And so Savage, for the rest of his career, according to his brother, kept trying to have a better match, and he never could. He never felt like he topped the match that he had with Steamboat in 87. He was that much of a perfectionist. And in the biggest main event in wrestling history, certainly WWE history at least, still to this day, there is no match more iconic than this one. Hulk Hogan beat Andre the Giant to retain the WWE Championship, a match that almost did not happen. Andre had been out months before this filming a role in the movie The Princess Bride. Right? He was Fezzik in the movie. And his back was completely thrashed. I mean, he was having a lot of problems, mobility problems. There were certain scenes in the movie, if you remember towards the end, one of the final scenes in that movie is Robin Wright, I think her name was, the female lead in the movie, jumps out of a window. Andre catches her in his arms. And I mean, she was, you know, she didn't weigh a lot. But I remember in one of the documentary little featurettes for the movie, they had to, I think, hold her up by... I don't remember the whole story, but it was something about holding her up by strings and lowering her. Like, Andre couldn't catch her because, again, his back was just in such bad shape. Even for something like that, they had to take certain measures and certain precautions because he just was not in a good way. And he wasn't even sure he was ever going to come back to the ring. He thought maybe his career might be over. So Vince McMahon went to go visit him, and he pitched the idea of a heel turn and doing a match with Hogan at WrestleMania. And Paul Orndorff, who had just gotten done feuding with Hogan, they had that big cage match a couple of months earlier on Saturday night's main event where they both hit the floor at the same time. He didn't wrestle on this show. Orndorff did not wrestle on the WrestleMania 3 card, and it wasn't because he was out, injured, or anything like that. He was on standby as a potential substitute in the event that Andre couldn't go, or if he backed out of the match. And the story has always been that Andre had back surgery before WrestleMania, and it's the story Vince McMahon has told many times in interviews, but in the Andre the Giant book that came out last year, and the writers did a tremendous job in that book, just a tremendous amount of research, spoke with Andre's family, his siblings, his friends. According to the book, the surgery didn't actually happen until July of 87, where they had to cut his back open, they had to widen his spine. Referee Tim White said it took months just to prepare for the operation because they didn't even have the scalpels and the tools that were big enough and necessary to work on somebody of Andre's size. They had to be custom made. But he was fitted with a back brace under his singlet at WrestleMania. He was drinking all afternoon before the match because there's no way he could have wrestled Stone Cold sober. That just wasn't going to happen. He was just in so much pain. As it was, he could barely move. I mean, if you watch that match, look, it's in the eye of the beholder. Everybody has a different definition for what they look at as a great pro wrestling match. That Hogan-Andre match, in a lot of ways, is the perfect pro wrestling match. If you look at it from a technical standpoint, it's shit. It's absolute garbage. Andre could barely move. Hogan spent three quarters of the match selling and writhing around. But that's all they really had to do. I mean, nobody had any expectations, I don't think, certainly not at that point, for Andre matches in work rate. I mean, nobody was really watching that expecting it. He did the best he could. He shouldn't have been in the ring in the first place. He did the best he could. But when he, when it was time, he went up for the slam, which is all anybody remembers. It was all to build to the body slam. Slam heard round the world. And they had claimed that he had never been slammed. He was undefeated for 15 years. It was all part of the hype going into the match. None of that was true. He had been slammed numerous times. He was not undefeated. But it didn't matter. It's part of the folklore of the match. And if you ask me to identify one, kind of the one moment that really symbolizes WWE, and you see it every week at the beginning of every one of their television shows in the opening signature, it's Hogan slamming Andre. 32 years ago on April 2nd, 1989, it was WrestleMania 5, the explosion of the Mega Powers, one of my all-time favorite angles, and one of the best matches of Hulk Hogan's career. This was the first WrestleMania for Mr. WrestleMania, Shawn Michaels, who was very hungover during the Rockers match against the Twin Towers after arguing with his wife, his first wife, Teresa, the night before, and he ended up staying out drinking until 4 in the morning with Marty Jannetty, but you would never know it. Watching him out there during this match, you would never know anything was wrong. Roddy Piper was back on TV for the first time in 2 years for a Piper's Pit segment with Brother Love and talk show host Morton Downey Jr., who was a thing at that time, unfortunately. The Ultimate Warrior suffered his first pinfall loss in WWE, dropping the Intercontinental title to Ravishing Rick Rude when Bobby Heenan reached in and held his foot down. And Hulk Hogan took the WWE title back from the Macho Man, who wrestled the match with a staph infection in his elbow. That is why he was wearing that giant white bandage on his arm, and that was the same elbow he dropped on Hogan during the match, too. Savage was in the hospital leading up to the match with a bursa sac that had broken and was infected with staph. In fact, I think he was in the hospital the morning of WrestleMania. They really would have been screwed if Savage wasn't able to do the match that night. I don't know what they would have done. I mean, think about it. If, let's say, Savage is in the hospital that morning and they just tell him point blank, you're not wrestling. Savage, based on what we've all read and know about him, probably would have escaped somehow. He would have dragged his ass down there no matter what. But in all seriousness, if Savage couldn't go for any reason, what would they have, on such short notice like that, what would they have done? I mean, you would have had to probably had somebody on the show pull double duty. I don't know, DiBiase, or, I mean, who knows? Title would have been held up, right? Because Hogan wasn't the champion, Savage was. And I think Savage understood that, and he wasn't going to miss that show. He wasn't going to miss that show. But that same night, WCW ran its Clash of the Champions, the Ragin' Cajun show, opposite WrestleMania. And unlike the success that they had the first show the year prior, opposite WrestleMania 4, that one did very well. That was the one where Flair basically made Sting in one night. This one, this didn't do so well. This didn't work out as well. They had only 5,300 people in the Superdome, which is a building that could have fit over 70,000 if they wanted to. But it did feature one of the greatest wrestling matches of all time between Ric Flair and Ricky Steamboat, 2 out of 3 falls, ran just shy of an hour. One of the trio of classics that Flair and Steamboat had back in 89. 31 years ago on April 1st, 1990, 5 days after Dr. George Zahorian was indicted on 15 counts of distributing controlled substances, including steroids, to various individuals, including WWE talent, WrestleMania left U.S. soil for the very first time, heading to the Sky Dome in Toronto in front of 67,000 fans for a rare babyface versus babyface main event, winner take all, for the WWF title and the Intercontinental title. Hulk Hogan, one-on-one against the Ultimate Warrior. I say rare. Every WrestleMania to have fallen so far to date on April Fool's Day, and there have been 4 of them so far, have all been headlined by a match between two babyfaces. As rare as it was, especially more so at that time. I mean, you just didn't see that. You didn't see that, period, at WrestleMania, let alone in the main event. But here, you know, going all the way back to 1990, you had Hogan Warrior. The next time was Austin Rock, which was X7. That also fell on April Fool's Day. John Cena and Shawn Michaels in 2007. And The Rock and John Cena, the first one. How weird is that? Very strange. This was a very big deal to a young fan like myself. I was on Team Hogan. One of my friends was on Team Warrior. And yet I was the one who had the Warrior wrestling buddy, and he was the one who had the Hogan wrestling buddy. I can't really explain that. I still have mine, by the way. I still have my Ultimate Warrior wrestling buddy. It's in a, I think it's in a giant plastic bag buried somewhere in the closet. Demolition on this show, three-peated as tag team champions with a win over Andre the Giant and Haku. After the match, Bobby Heenan slapped Andre right across the face. That was a big mistake. And Andre paintbrushed him, beat up Haku, before exiting to a chorus of cheers on one of those motorized carts. This was Andre's final televised match for WWE, his final ever WrestleMania match. And I thought it was a very fitting final scene, watching him exit as a babyface once again on that cart, looking back at the ring, getting cheered on his way out, big stadium. It was a an appropriate scene. Roddy Piper. Oh, Roddy Piper. He painted his body, not just his face. He painted his entire body. Half of it. Half black. For a match with Bad News Brown that has since been removed from the WWE Network and from Peacock. So this is rather timely here to tell this story. In his book, as he did in his promo before the match, which I believe has also been cut from the network version, Piper explained that he did it to show that it didn't matter what the color of your skin was, he represented all people. And in an interview years later, with Arda Ocal, Piper had this to say about this whole situation. I just thought this story was too good not to share. So we have to tell this story right from the horse's mouth. This is from Roddy Piper in this interview that he did years ago. He says, I was born in Saskatoon. There are no black people that I know of that are dumb enough to go to a place that cold. So there's no racism in me at all. At the time, I was walking down the hall of some arena. It might have been the Hoosier Dome. Someplace, I'm not sure. Vince McMahon says, Hot Rod, I need to speak with you. I walked into a room and you could have cut the air with a knife. It was Bad News Brown, Pat Patterson, and Vince McMahon. I said, what's going on? He says, I want you to wrestle Bad News at WrestleMania. I'm looking at Bad News, who was really a good judo player. Judo player, I like that. And just a so-so professional wrestler. And here's what's going through my mind. I'm looking at him and I'm going, I'm going to have 45 interviews about this guy. And I'm thinking, Nelson Mandela at that time had said something that really stuck with me. He was put in jail for 20-some years for political crimes. Every morning he was the first man when the guard came to extend his hand to the guard. What a hell of a man. At the same time, Cyndi Lauper had True Colors out. In my mind, what I was trying to do, there is no difference. I needed material on Bad News Brown. The stuff they had painted me with, Vince had made special, so that when I broke a sweat, it wouldn't come off. There was a special clear solution to take this special black off. When I got there, the lady started rubbing my cheeks, and in about 5 minutes, I started bleeding. Andre the Giant had taken the solution, poured it out, and put water in it. Now, I'm in Toronto, half black. I decided there's nothing much to do than just to go out drinking. So I go and I'm drinking and I'm half black in the bar. Next morning, and don't judge me, he says, I wake up and the door of my hotel room is blown completely off and there's a cowboy hat in the middle of my room. I don't know whose. I wake up and I'm half black. I gotta go from Toronto to Portland, Oregon. I got a 4-foot Mickey Mouse with me that I bought for my daughter. So, because I didn't know, I put the hat on, and I've got a 4-foot Mickey Mouse, a Halliburton, and a hangover, and I'm half black. I'm completely half black, other than the scar under my eye. So, I'm going through Chicago, and I'm going through customs. When you're half black and half white, they just go right ahead. They part like the Nile. In Chicago, I had to change planes, and the flight attendant wanted me to check Mickey Mouse because it was too big. So I bought Mickey a first-class seat with me, and Mickey drank all the way to Portland. The way I got it off was that I had to sit in a sauna. Took me about a month of rubbing this stuff off. But what am I going to go do? Beat up Andre? That is a great story. That is a fucking great story. Still don't understand why he painted himself half black, but that is a great story. Dusty Rhodes, tagged with Sapphire in the first ever mixed tag match in WrestleMania history against the Macho King and Sensational Sherry. And if you wanted to ask any of them about this match, sadly, you wouldn't be able to because they're all dead, including Elizabeth, who appeared at the very end. Diamond Dallas Page made his WWE debut not as a wrestler, but as a driver. He was friends with Bushwhacker Luke, who knew Dallas owned a pink Cadillac. And WWE was looking for someone with a classic car to drive rhythm and blues to the ring of WrestleMania for their match. Pat Patterson asked Dallas, how much would it cost for us to rent the car from you? And Dallas said, look, I'll tell you what. If you pay to ship the car to Toronto and you fly me in and you put me up, I'll drive down the aisle for free. I'll drive the car for you. I won't even charge you for it. So that's what they did. And in the main event, Hulk Hogan missed the big leg drop. The Ultimate Warrior splashed him for the win. Although Hogan did make sure to kick out at the count of 3.1. He supposedly passed the torch to the Ultimate Warrior that night. Although in his book, Bret Hart claims that when Hogan got to the back that night, he told him, you watch, Warrior will fail, and Vince will be calling me, begging me to come back. And Bret liked Hogan at that time. He actually said he was rooting for that to happen. This is before Bret had any kind of animosity towards Hogan, which he obviously did many years later. So Bret said he wanted to see that happen, but Bret would live to regret those thoughts 3 years later, on April 4th, 1993, when WrestleMania came to Caesar's Palace. Let me say the way that Vince McMahon said it. Caesar's Palace. There you go. Almost. Vince was great on those old intros. Vince, he used to be fantastic at that. But this was the night that Jim Ross made his WWE broadcast debut wearing a toga. Not a vision that I think any of us care to go back and see. But Jim Ross had been demoted and taken off of WCW television the month before this, or a little over a month before this. And there was a lot of controversy at that time because Jim Ross had a radio show in Atlanta that was sponsored by WCW. And shortly before WrestleMania, in an unannounced surprise, he came on the air of his radio show, and who did he have with him? Vince McMahon, Bobby Heenan, and Shawn Michaels as his guests to preview WrestleMania 9. And this here is from the April 5th, 1993 issue of the Wrestling Observer. On the show, McMahon made the announcement that Ross was joining the WWF, hyping him as the premier announcer in the business, saying that Christmas came early this year because they got Jim Ross, which was the equivalent of John Madden jumping from CBS to NBC. I have a soft spot for this show. It's not a great show. I'm not going to sit here and try to tell you, oh, here's why WrestleMania 9 is so great. There's just something about the show as the years have gone on, and I hear a lot of people and I see a lot of people shit on it. And again, it would not be anywhere close to even the first half of a top WrestleManias of all time list. But, you know, it's just unique enough that I kind of like it, even though it doesn't really feel like a WrestleMania. Hulk Hogan challenged for the tag team titles for the first time at WrestleMania. He did not win them, but he won a much bigger prize at the end of the night. Hogan was also sporting a black eye on this show that they claimed was from a jet ski accident. But the urban legend over the years is that Randy Savage got into a heated argument with Hogan before the show, punched him in the face. Savage did go off on Hogan later that year in a radio WWF interview for Hogan and his wife and his view playing a part in his marriage falling apart to Elizabeth. I know he put a lot of the blame on Hogan for that. So who knows? Who knows what the truth is and if the punch happened or not? A jet ski accident, I would think it would have done a lot more damage than one black eye. But again, who knows what happened? Savage got in the ring when the show was over and Hogan was celebrating. They went off the air. Savage had been doing commentary at ringside. There is footage. This was on one of these WWE DVD releases in the last several years. So there's footage of Savage climbing into the ring when the show is over. And the cameras were not shooting this live. And he's in the ring and holding up Hogan's arm and celebrating with Hogan. And I don't know. I mean, you would think they're not on the air. Why would Savage voluntarily get in the ring and do that if he had such a personal beef at that time with Hogan? But in any event, Bret Hart only found out that he was dropping the title to Yokozuna the day before the show. He was shocked. He was dismayed. He was blindsided by the news. He was also pissed at Yokozuna during their match for going home early, cutting out all of Bret's big comeback spots that they had planned. Yoko won the title. Out came Hulk Hogan to the rescue. 2 minutes later, Hogan was the champion. And Bret says that in the back, Hogan came up to him, big smile on his face, and thanked him and told him he won't forget it. He looks forward to returning the favor to him. Bret looked him dead in the eye and said, "I'm going to remember that, Terry. I'm going to hold you to that." And in late May, Bret claims that Vince McMahon called to tell him that he was going to get the belt back and Hogan was going to be used as more of a special attraction from that point on. And Bret was excited. He goes, "Great, this is fantastic news." 10 days later, McMahon said that Hogan was refusing. This is what he told Bret. He said Hogan was refusing to put him over. And so Vince decided that they were just going to give the belt back to Yokozuna, put it on him. And instead, Bret would work with Jerry Lawler at SummerSlam. And he even says, Bret, that he showed up at the King of the Ring in June in a very bad mood. He drew a cartoon of Brutus Beefcake with his face buried in Hogan's ass cheeks with the caption, "Be careful, Brutus, you don't want to loosen the screws in your face." Speaking of screws. But he felt bad. He said he admitted he felt bad because he was taking his frustrations out on Beefcake, who didn't do anything wrong and it wasn't right. For his part, Hogan, in an interview with Peter Rosenberg a few years ago, claims that he made a deal with Vince McMahon to drop the belt to Yokozuna. But Vince told Bret that he was getting the belt. And when Bret confronted Hulk, Hogan says, "Look, brother, it's not that I don't want to drop the belt to you, brother. It's just that it's not the deal that I made, dude." As if he didn't have the power to change this alleged deal that he made with Vince McMahon. Give me a fucking break. He says that they both met with Vince. Vince McMahon told Bret, "You getting the belt is what you thought you heard." And Hogan said that if Vince had asked him to drop the belt to Bret, he would have done it. But Vince never asked him. Instead, he asked him to drop it to Yokozuna. Hogan felt that's what had to be done. So I will leave it up to you to decide who is more credible and who is mostly full of shit in their retelling of these stories. But Hogan putting over Bret Hart at SummerSlam in 93 would have been huge. It would have been huge for Bret, and it would not have hurt Hogan one single bit. I don't care how much smaller he was than Hogan. You know, Hogan was bigger than Bret, but even at that point in 93, Hogan wasn't that big compared to his peak when he looked like a fucking monster. You know, Bret was not a midget. So this whole thing about the size difference and how unbelievable it was, you know what? Maybe if Bret were in there with 86 or 87 Hogan, you know, when he was all jacked and roided up, I mean, that might be different. But there was absolutely a way that they could have worked that match. You know, maybe Hogan wouldn't have submitted to the sharpshooter, but they could have absolutely did that match and had a true passing of the torch. And Hogan either could have left if he wanted to, or he could have been that special attraction that Vince McMahon had talked to Bret Hart about. But anyway, it didn't work out. Didn't work out, but I'll leave that up to you. Hogan putting over Bret would have been huge. And then he could have come through the curtain and he could have told Shawn Michaels in the back, "You watch, Bret's going to fail. And Vince will be calling me, begging me to come back." We could have history repeat itself. 26 years ago this week, on April 2nd, 1995. You can't mention WrestleMania 9 as one of the worst WrestleManias of all time without including this show on that list. Built around former NFL star Lawrence Taylor, wrestling Bam Bam Bigelow in the main event, they had a decent match. And I guess when you pay somebody $500,000, they're going to get the main event spot, whether they deserve it or not. Yokozuna returned for the first time since Survivor Series, heavier than ever, as Owen Hart's mystery partner to win the tag team titles from the Smoking Guns. They put Yokozuna in the team because his weight was so bad. He was so morbidly obese, even by that point in 90, and it would only get worse, but even in 95, he was so morbidly obese, they couldn't book him as a full-time single anymore. He just couldn't do it. So it was going to be Jim Neidhart originally was going to be Owen's tag team partner. They had been together for most of 94 when Jim made his return. But he no-showed some events around, I think it was like around Christmas time, and he got fired. So Neidhart was gone. Then there was some chatter that Chris Benoit might be brought in as Owen's partner. In fact, Benoit did do some dark matches for the company in 95, and there's even pictures of him coming down to the ring with Ted DiBiase. They put DiBiase in his corner as his manager. They ended up not hiring him. I think those dark matches came months after WrestleMania. But in some of the newsletters at that time, there definitely was some chatter about Benoit possibly being the partner, but they went with Yoko instead. Now, in his book, Bret Hart called his match with Bob Backlund, they had an I Quit match on the show, he called it, without a doubt, my worst pay-per-view match ever. And He ain't wrong. My cable went out during the finish of this match. Just as Backlund was trying to lock in the chicken wing, I got a blue screen. Not the blue screen that my Windows 10 machine gives me, but I got a blue screen from the cable provider. When it finally came back on a few minutes later, Brett was already celebrating. His music was playing, so I missed the whole finish. But this match was no good. Diesel defended the WWF title in the semi-main against Shawn Michaels. Vince McMahon insisted that Diesel kick out at one after eating a super kick from Shawn Michaels, which both men argued against. Diesel rightfully thought that it's going to turn the crowd against me. He was already being shoved down people's throats. He was already well aware of this. He goes, please, let's not do this. This is not going to go over well with the audience. Vince McMahon insisted on it. They did the spot, and sure enough, the fans booed. And in his book, Shawn Michaels says that Vince McMahon admitted later on after the show that it was a mistake. The powerbomb at the finish of that match always irks me. Even back then, it irked me. Because I knew it looked like shit. Michaels over-rotated on the jackknife, landed on his ass. He almost landed on his feet. Kevin Nash is convinced. I mean, they're best friends, Nash and Michaels, but, you know, wrestling is very competitive. They were fighting for the same spot. Even then, even though they were best of buds, he knew that Shawn wanted to be in the spot that he was in. And I don't doubt for a second the possibility that Shawn Michaels had or harbored a lot of jealousy to Nash, because Michaels had been in the company for a number of years. Michaels, I think, is the one who helped bring Kevin Nash into the company. And now Kevin Nash is in the spot that he's in before he ever had a chance to even get there. So how could there not be any kind of underlying jealousy on his part? Nash, in shoot interviews, has talked about how he is convinced that Shawn did that on purpose at the finish. He fucked up the jackknife on purpose to try to make him look bad. He was very open about it in one of his shoots with Shawn Oliver. He says that even though they were friends, he knew that Shawn was gunning for his spot. Everybody in the locker room knew it. They were very competitive in that way. And he is sure that Shawn took the move that way on purpose to sabotage him. But they had a good match. Not as good as their Good Friends, Better Enemies match the following year, but it was still a good match. And for his 12 minutes of work in the main event, losing to Lawrence Taylor, Bam Bam Bigelow earned $250,000, he claimed, or half of what LT pulled in for the event. Jim Cornette remembers that LT, he was so blown up when the match was over. As soon as he got back through the curtain, he had to be placed in a chair. As soon as he got to the back, he couldn't even speak. The following year, on March 31st, 1996, WrestleMania 12. Can you believe it's been 25 years since the Iron Man match between Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels? Unbelievable. I still have a map plaque from that show that has a piece of the canvas in it. The Huckster took on the Nacho Man on the free-for-all pre-show with Billionaire Ted as the guest referee. When Vader came into the company, which was only a couple of months before this, made his debut at the Royal Rumble, he had a bad shoulder, which apparently was only getting worse. It was really nagging him. That's why they shot the angle on Raw the night after he debuted at the Rumble, and he assaulted Gorilla Monsoon, and they suspended him. You would think, why are they suspending this guy? He literally just made his debut. He had to have surgery. So that was their way of getting him off TV. So he goes, and he has shoulder surgery. Vince McMahon then a few weeks later calls him and says, hey, we need you for WrestleMania. And Vader was not happy about that. But he's brand new in this company, and the boss says, we need you. So what's he going to do? Tell him to piss off? So originally, this was going to be a singles match, and they actually announced it on television. They had a graphic for it and everything. It was going to be one-on-one Yokozuna against Vader. It turned into a six-man tag. I'm assuming that was done at least in part because of Vader's injury. But it turned into Vader, Owen Hart, and the British Bulldog against Yoko, Ahmed Johnson, and Jake the Snake Roberts, which actually turned out to be a pretty good match, as I recall. The Miami Alley Fight. You might be asking, a Miami what? What are you talking about? There was a Miami Alley Fight that was originally scheduled between Goldust and Razor Ramon. It was set up in a segment on television that never actually aired on TV, but it was included on a recent unreleased matches, unreleased segments, WWE DVD. This whole interview segment with Razor and Roddy Piper, who was the interim acting president on television at the time, setting up what would have been a Miami Alley Fight between Razor and Goldust, who had been feuding at that time. Goldust had beaten Razor at the Rumble to win the IC title. That segment, by the way, was up on the network. So good luck finding it now, because I don't think you will. But it never took place because Razor had faxed his resignation letter the month prior to Vince McMahon. He was on his way out. He was leaving for WCW. He also failed a drug test around that time, so they took him off the show. They replaced him with Roddy Piper in what they instead called a Hollywood backlot brawl against Goldust, first half of which was filmed 3 weeks before the pay-per-view. It was edited into the show to make it look like it was happening live. But that was not the original plan for Roddy Piper on this show. Not only did Goldust have a different opponent originally, Piper had a totally different opponent, and it was an opponent that you would never guess. Ramon was going to fight Goldust, but according to Bruce Pritchard, the plan was for Piper to have a match with O.J. Simpson. 6 months after he was acquitted of brutally murdering two people. Pritchard said, "I remember calling Roddy and pitching him the idea, which he was for. We had preliminary talks with OJ's people, who at that point were looking for anything that had a paycheck attached to it. We floated the idea out there. We did talk to OJ's people. I talked to Piper about it. Piper was on board. If you go back in the early time of Piper's reemergence with WWE, he does make comments about OJ Simpson. He makes comments about right and wrong in America, what's going on, and that he's here to make things right in the WWF. The end game was going to be a one-off and have Piper beat the shit out of OJ Simpson at WrestleMania. But once that started getting out beyond the inner circle of OJ's people and out in Hollywood, the backlash was deafening. The people were like, if you do this, you'll never have another sponsor. Just extremely, extremely negative. So we punted. We thought the end game of OJ getting the shit kicked out of him would satisfy some people. As those words come out of my mouth, you realize how ridiculous it is today. But you always have to try something, even if it sounds ridiculous." And that, folks, is what it means to be in the wrestling bubble. Think about how fucking absurd that sounds. I think as Pritchard was saying it, it sounds like he realized how ridiculous it sounded even as he was telling that story. The fact that, oh, you know, we thought it would be cool because, you know, here in this fake fight, we're going to have Piper, you know, pretend to be kicking the shit out of OJ Simpson, who would be getting a big payday out of it. But hey, he would be getting fake beaten up, so it's all good, right? That is the definition of being in the wrestling. Actually, that's the definition of being a fucking idiot is what that is. So thankfully that didn't happen. By the way, I think that last statement he made about you have to try something, even if it's ridiculous, you always got to try something, even if it sounds stupid. I think that last statement explains a lot when it comes to their shows today. They obviously were planning something with OJ because they even replicated the White Bronco chase with Piper and Goldust during their backlot brawl. They brought back the Ultimate Warrior on this show, who looked so out of place here in 1996. Physically, he looked great. He was back in his warrior shape. His hair had grown back out longer. He had cut it years before. I think that the fact that he had cut his hair short and that he was so much smaller when he came back in 92, that is what spurred on all the rumors that the Ultimate Warrior died in a car accident. This is the fake Ultimate Warrior. There was only one Ultimate Warrior. This version of the Warrior in 96 looked more like the Warrior of old. So he looked fine, but he just looked out of place in what was this new generation era, an era of guys who were smaller, who didn't look all big and jacked up like he did. So it was just weird. And he squashed Triple H in 90 seconds in Triple H's first WrestleMania match. He took the pedigree. He got right back up and totally no-sold it, which was not the original plan. But when Triple H went to Warrior with some ideas on what they could do, Warrior basically, in so many words, said, fuck you, no, we're going to do it my way. And of course, he didn't last much longer after that, did the Warrior, because he was a raving lunatic. And the Iron Man match. Iron Man match is held up as this all-time classic. I think it's a very good match, but it's not even the best Iron Man match that I've ever seen, let alone the best match. I've said before, I think this match is very overrated. That doesn't mean it's a bad match. I just think it's very overrated by people. My opinion. The two of them didn't even put the match together until the day of the show. Didn't even talk about it. And then that day they sat together for about 3 hours, putting the entire thing together. Total pros. That's all they needed. 3 hours to put together a 61-minute match. The next night on Raw, Mick Foley debuted as Mankind. Vince McMahon did not want to hire Mick Foley. Multiple times they turned down the chance to hire Mick Foley. It was Jim Ross who went to bat for him. And Vince McMahon said, you know what, JR? I'm going to let you hire this guy because sometimes you have to let certain talent break your heart. He was convinced that this was not going to work out, and he said, it's on you. If it doesn't work out, it's on you. I think it worked out. I would say that signing worked out pretty well. Not only did it work out pretty well, but Mankind, to me, is still the greatest of all of The Undertaker's opponents. When I look back at all the feuds and the rivalries, I mean, Undertaker may have had better matches with Shawn Michaels and stuff, and I know people look back fondly on the matches with Kane and the whole storyline with Kane. I will always maintain that Mankind is Undertaker's greatest rival. He gave Undertaker a run for his money in 96 from the day he walked in the way that nobody else ever did. And the matches they had from their Boiler Room Brawl at SummerSlam, obviously Hell in a Cell at the King of the Ring, they had a lot of matches in between there. He is Undertaker's greatest rival. 23 years ago this week, on March 29th, 1998, the Austin era began at WrestleMania 14. Chris Warren and the DX band opened the show by butchering America the Beautiful. A lot of people in the back hated it. The only person who seemed to like it was Vince McMahon. But it was edited off the network version of WrestleMania. It is not on the Peacock version either. Sable and Mark Mero beat Luna Vachon and Goldust in Sable's first match, or at least her first big match. Luna claimed that she was told if she so much as put a black and blue mark on Sable, if she hurt her in any way, you know, accidentally, if anything happened, she would be fired. She never said who said that to her, but that's what she claimed she was told. Luna put a lot of effort in to make Sable look her very best in that match, and the only person who came up to her when the match was over, when they got back through the curtain, the only person who came up to her to give her a pat on the back for a job well done was Owen Hart. She said that meant a lot to her. Mick Foley tagged with Terry Funk as Chainsaw Charlie on this show against the New Age Outlaws in a dumpster match for the tag team titles, but he had proposed a very different idea for WrestleMania. Him and Funk not as partners, but as adversaries. He had proposed to Vince McMahon the idea of a best of seven deathmatch series, leading to the seventh and final match of WrestleMania, live via satellite from Funk's Double Cross Ranch down in Texas. A no ropes, barbed wire, exploding C4 deathmatch. He pitched the idea to Vince McMahon, who was on board with it, but with a lot of media eyes on the show due to Mike Tyson's involvement, the idea got nixed. Kane, Tombstone Pete Rose before his match with The Undertaker, and Stone Cold Steve Austin pinned Shawn Michaels to win his first WWE title with Iron Mike Tyson counting the three, turning against DX. Austin winning the title from his old rival Bret Hart was considered as the early main event for WrestleMania in 98. But then something happened in Montreal and suddenly Brett was unavailable. But that would have been the natural match if Brett had stuck around, if that never happened. And Brett was still the champion. He never dropped the belt. Austin never did get a straight up pinfall win over Brett on TV. Would have made sense to have Austin finally get that big win, beat Brett, and become the champion. Shawn Michaels had to wash down 4 pain pills, according to his book, before the match to get through it. His back was completely just demolished at that point. And he was adamant before the match, as they were going over different ideas and spots, and here's the plan, here's what's going to happen. He was adamant that Mike Tyson not place an Austin 316 shirt over his face after Tyson knocked him out. He told Pat Patterson, who was really gung-ho about the idea, he said to Patterson, look, I'm going to walk out. If you keep insisting on this, I'm going to walk out. So they relented. Tyson ended up doing it anyway. And Michaels made it very clear after the show was over, there was a post-show press conference with Austin and Tyson, and in the back of the room, who should storm in through the doors, but very angry Shawn Michaels, who was confronted by Shane McMahon trying to calm him down, and Michaels was going off on Shane and explaining that after everything I've done for this company, this is what you do, that's the disrespect that you show me. So he had to be calmed down. Eventually, Michaels walked away. Undertaker also revealed on the Broken Skull Sessions recently that he lied to Shawn Michaels when he told him that whole story about him taping up his fists in the back just in case things went sideways. Oh, that's just an urban legend. In fact, that's exactly what happened. Undertaker was ready to force Michaels back to that ring that night if he played any games. There were rumors that Michaels might not want to do business. He might not want to put Austin over. There was a lot of stuff going, a lot of drama going on in the back. Undertaker was ready to throw down if need be. Because he knew Austin is going to be our meal ticket. Austin's the next big thing here in this company. He's the one that they're building around. You got to do business. Undertaker's all about doing business. And if Michaels didn't want to do business, then Undertaker was going to do something about it. And on Raw the next night, Sean Waltman returned to the company as Triple H took over as the new leader of D-Generation X. And it was the end of an era. Oh, broke my heart to see this. The end of the Reggie Parks Winged Eagle Championship belt in favor of the new J-Mar Big Eagle belt that they gave Stone Cold. You know, the Big Eagle that was popularized during the Attitude Era, that's a beautiful belt, too. I actually have both replicas here. It looked very different. It kind of evolved. The first J-Mar belt with that blue strap that debuted looked like a SmackDown belt. It was a nice-looking belt, but it was a little bit different than what it ultimately morphed into. But that was the new belt that they debuted, and Austin said on a podcast years ago that he was backstage at an event and Road Warrior Hawk was the one who suggested that, you know what, you should have your own belt to fit this whole idea that you're a rebel and you don't do what people tell you to do. You don't conform. You don't do what the company tells you to do. You don't just carry around the company's, you know, property. You should have your own belt made. And from that came the concept of the Smoking Skull belt. Funny enough, Hawk is also the one who came up with the idea for the name Paul Bear as a manager for The Undertaker. And when did he come up with this idea, supposedly? He came up with this idea while on the commode in the bathroom in the locker room. I don't know, maybe he overheard a conversation that was happening or whatever. I could just picture it like he's in the bathroom. You don't see him, but you hear him. How about Paul Bear? And just like that, a legend was born. Hey, look, some of us do our best thinking on the throne. Apparently, Hawk was very creative. He had a very creative mind, even when he was on the toilet. So Austin, without WWE's knowledge, he said nothing to the company. He said nothing to Vince McMahon. He went to J-Mar, and he had them create a new belt. There were actually 2 belts made, a silver and a gold Smoking Skull design. I've seen the photo of he with the belt maker holding up both of them. Austin kept the silver one for himself, and he used the gold one on TV the first time without Vince McMahon's knowledge. And apparently McMahon was really pissed off about it, and he ordered him to use their belt, use the Big Eagle belt, which he did. But the fan reaction was so intense, McMahon ultimately relented, and he let Austin go ahead and use the Smoking Skull belt, which I'm sure they've made mucho dinero off of, with all the belt replicas. Belt replicas are a very big business right now for WWE, more so now than ever. That's why you see them coming out with all these custom belts. A few months ago, they released a commemorative China Intercontinental belt. They had an Eddie Guerrero commemorative belt with the leather strap. It was the same design as the tights that he wore the night that he beat Brock Lesnar. They have an Undertaker belt, an Austin, like a different Austin belt. It's big business. I'm sure they've sold a lot of those Smoking Skull belts over the years. WrestleMania 2000. Had a 12-hour WrestleMania all-day-long pre-show leading up to the event. Was it 12 hours? Maybe it was 8 hours. I don't know. It was a long-ass time, and I know this because I sat through the whole damn thing because I'm an idiot. I am an idiot. I don't know. I just like... Back then, there was no network, right? You had your tapes. That was it. So them showing classic footage of all the WrestleManias and the old stuff with Hogan and Savage and everything else, like, I lived for that. So I wanted to make sure that I was watching it. I took a few bathroom breaks. But I had that on my TV all day leading up to WrestleMania that night. The show featured 11 hardcore title changes and a hardcore battle royal, where Crash Holly was supposed to retain, but referee Tim White had someone missed timed the count in his ear. They were like counting him down or something, and they fucked up the timing of the finish. So Hardcore Holly won the belt instead. Tim White got reamed out in the back over it. Really wasn't his fault. Hardcore Holly later in the show yelled at Michael Cole in a backstage interview segment, called him a little shithead, and walked off. Well, hey, you know, if the shoe fits. And in a prelude to their TLC matches, Edge and Christian won a triangle ladder match for the tag team titles over the Hardys and the Dudleys. Chris Jericho, he was on the original poster for this show, poster art, for the Fatal 4-Way main event, but he was removed weeks before the show when they made the call to unretire Mick Foley, who had just retired the month before. Unretired him to give him a spot in the WrestleMania main event. And Triple H became the first heel to close out the WrestleMania main event with a championship win. Of course, that should have been Triple H and Rock one-on-one, but Stone Cold was not ready to come back yet. He was still recovering from neck surgery. They did get Austin back the following month at Backlash. And I always say, and a lot of people do, I think, say the same thing, that the Backlash that year was WrestleMania. If you look at that car, you had Jericho and Benoit one-on-one. You had Rock and Triple H, which is what the main event should have been. There were a couple of other matches. I know they had the light heavyweight title match. I think it was Scotty Too Hotty and Dean Malenko. That ended up being a very good match as well. But you look at that card, especially that main event, that really was WrestleMania. WrestleMania came a month later that year. Which brings us to, probably top to bottom, the greatest WrestleMania of all time. WrestleMania X7 on April 1st, 2001, from the Houston Astrodome, the end of the Attitude Era. The Attitude Era died when Stone Cold shook hands with Vince McMahon. It died. And so did business, although not right away. But it did begin a steady decline from their peak for the company. It was a busy week leading up to WrestleMania. WWE bought WCW. We had the Raw Nitro simulcast 6 days before this show. That very same night, that Monday before WrestleMania, Shawn Michaels, who was to have been involved in some capacity in the show, possibly in the Undertaker Triple H match, I don't think as a referee, but he very likely would have had some kind of role. He would have made some kind of appearance on the pay-per-view. He showed up to Raw that Monday in no condition to perform. He was all pilled up or boozed up or maybe both. And he started an argument with Chris Jericho at Gorilla over the fact that he was dressed up as Doink the Clown, which Jericho was because he was doing a segment. He was doing a run-in on a segment or a match with William Regal, who was his opponent at WrestleMania. Per Jericho's second book, the exchange went something like this, with Sean's eyes drooping and he was slurring his words. This is how the exchange went. "Are you doing the Doink gimmick now?" "No, I'm just doing it for tonight. I'm ambushing Regal." "So you're going to be Doink now?" "No, no, I'm just doing it for one night as a way to surprise Regal." "But why do you have to be Doink?" "But I'm not Doink, Sean. It's just for tonight." And Shawn Michaels shakes his head and just walks off. "I don't like it. They should never have made you Doink." Jericho said it felt like an Abbott and Costello Who's on First routine, only it was Who's on Drugs. His words. Michaels ended up passing out in Vince McMahon's office and he was fired. And he didn't speak with Triple H for more than a year after that because he felt that he did stick up for him. I've heard different accounts of this. Either that he didn't stick up for him, or Triple H may have been the one to kind of drop a dime on him and rat him out when he found him in Vince's office. I don't know exactly how it played out, but Michaels clearly was not happy with Triple H, and I think ultimately it was Kevin Nash who kind of talked to Sean and said, "Look, you got to reach out to Hunter on this, and you guys got to patch things up," and eventually they were able to make nice. Shane McMahon beat Vince McMahon in a match where Linda McMahon got one of the biggest pops of the night. No joke. Who would have thunk it? It's a great moment, though, watching her rise up from that chair. Edge and Christian won TLC 2. And we got the iconic spear to Jeff Hardy off the ladder from about 16 feet up in the air. And then Jeff knocked out Spike Dudley's front teeth with a swanton bomb. The Iron Sheik won a gimmick battle royal of old-timers, because he was too fucking old and decrepit to be thrown out over the top rope. So, of course, he was going to win. Bobby Heenan had the great line, "By the time he makes it to the ring, it'll be WrestleMania 38. It was the last time we had Bobby Heenan on commentary. He sat alongside Mean Gene Okerlund for the Battle Royal. And it makes me sad, because you know that if Gorilla Monsoon was still alive, and he was doing well, he wasn't sick, we would have had a Monsoon and Heenan reunion that night. Oh, it would have been that. I mean, you talk about this WrestleMania being maybe the greatest of all time. This would have just sealed the deal. To get Monsoon and Heenan back on commentary, even just for one comedy match. Are you kidding me? And Stone Cold beat The Rock to win the WWE title with an assist from Vince McMahon, who he shook hands with after the match. They turned him heel in Texas, even though the people cheered for him anyway. It was Austin's idea to turn heel. He thought that he was getting stale and he wanted to try something different. But he did briefly think of calling an audible. He almost had second thoughts, and in the moment, he thought of, after shaking Vince's hand, kicking him in the gut and dropping him with a stunner, but he decided against it. 18 years ago this week on March 30th, 2003, WrestleMania 19 from Safeco Field in Seattle, a stacked card on paper, and yet it did a laughably bad 550,000 pay-per-view buys, which for a WrestleMania, especially back then, that is a terrible number. That is a terrible drop. We can sit here and ponder exactly why it was. Was it just the fact that the main event was weak, you know, Angle and Lesnar? They just weren't big enough stars at that point, or because really they were pushing McMahon and Hogan more than Angle Lesnar as the main. I mean, Angle Lesnar went on last, but they were promoting Hogan McMahon like it was the main event of WrestleMania. Maybe people just didn't want to see those two old guys in the ring one on one. Who knows? Nathan Jones was pulled last minute from a tag team match. He was supposed to team up with The Undertaker against The Big Show and A-Train, I believe. He was pulled from the match at the last minute because he sucked. He sucked so bad. And no matter how much they practiced leading up to the show, there were stories about him practicing Undertaker's home or whatever. They had a ring and they would practice. He was the shits. He was no good. He was hopeless. So they shot an injury angle on the pre-show just to get him out of there. So all he had to do at the very end was do a run-in, and was probably better off that way. But this was a waste for The Undertaker and the streak and everything. This was just a complete waste of a year. Triple H beat Booker T to retain the World Heavyweight title. Do we really need to go through this again? If Peacock is removing stuff that's even remotely racist and offensive, they can get rid of this whole friggin' feud for all I care. The way this thing was built up, you know, if Triple H was going to win, if Triple H was going to retain, then there was a different way they should have built this match. Everything they did to build this match up, every insult that Triple H threw in this guy's face, people like you don't belong or become a world champion, you could dance for me, all the fucking racist bullshit, clearly racial overtones. Don't give me this shit, it wasn't racist. They knew what they were doing. They were playing it up. And I'm not even saying it was right or wrong, but the bottom line is, if you're going to do that, at least in the end, the babyface should come out on top. And there was a spot in this match where Booker hit a pretty brutal-looking Harlem Hangover off the top rope to Triple H. That should have been the finish. Not only did Booker T lose, it was the way in which he lost that night. Triple H hit him with one pedigree, and it took about 7 years for him to crawl over and finally cover Booker T. And even after all of that time had gone by, Booker did not kick out. They made this guy look like a fool. And that is why this sucked. Shawn Michaels made his WrestleMania return one-on-one against Chris Jericho. Michaels, who had missed 4.5 years, came back. He had that great street fight with Triple H at SummerSlam. He had the big title win in the Elimination Chamber. Michaels wasn't even sure he was going to come back for any more matches. He didn't have any kind of long-term plan in mind. Jericho had to talk him into doing the match of Mania. I'm glad he did. It went out there and they had an excellent match. And actually, I think as the story goes, they had such a good match, and Michaels knew it was a good match, they went over their allotted time. And when he came to the back, I don't know who it was, one of the agents maybe, said something about, you know, you guys went long, and Michaels made a comment to the effect of, when you have a match as good as the one that we just had, you can go long. You can afford to go long. Michaels has a history of doing that. He has a history of going long at WrestleMania. He did that with Razor at WrestleMania 10, and Macho Man chewed him out in the back for not respecting the other talent on the show. So apparently, history repeated itself. Hulk Hogan beat Vince McMahon in a match that was better than it had any right to be. Roddy Piper made a cameo, hit Hogan in the head with a pipe, but Hogan still managed to pull off the win. Piper made it very clear to the company when he signed to come back. He had done an interview with HBO's Real Sports for a segment that they were doing that was going to be airing in the next few weeks or months, and the company was okay with it. When the segment finally aired in June of that year, they weren't so happy with it. And that led to Piper being fired. That was the same interview where Roddy Piper said, I know I'm not going to live to the age of 65. And he ended up passing away, I think he was 61, when he died. Stone Cold and The Rock. Part 3. With Rock finally getting a win. This after Austin spent the night before and the morning of WrestleMania in the hospital with what he thought might have been a heart attack. He thought he was having a heart attack. It turned out to be an elevated heart rate from downing so much coffee and energy drinks the day before. His heart was just racing a million miles an hour. The fans had no idea that it was going to be Austin's last match. Even if you would have told them, if the match would have been promoted as a retirement match and Austin lost, the people still would not have believed. If you would say to them, here in the year 2021, Stone Cold never came back to wrestle. It's been 18 years. people would have called you a liar, because how many people in wrestling, how many big names in wrestling like Austin retire? Even when they retire at an age that they should retire, let alone if they retire prematurely, don't come back. How many people don't come back? You can count them on one hand. They all come back, unless they're physically incapable of coming back. They all come back. Austin did not come back. Austin stayed true to his word. It's been 18 years, and he has not had a match since. He even had OMR on his vest that night when he walked out. One more round. And, of course, in the main event, Brock Lesnar beat Kurt Angle to win back the WWE Championship. I touched on this a little bit in some of the other history segments in recent weeks. They gave this match away on or they were going to give this match away on television a few weeks before WrestleMania, about 3 weeks or 2.5 weeks before the show. Kurt Angle had a broken neck. Surprise, surprise. And Kurt was going to need surgery. And they thought, we got to get the belt off Angle. We'll do the match on TV. Brock will win. And in Kurt's place at WrestleMania, we'll put Chris Benoit. And it was going to be Lesnar defending the title against Benoit as the backup plan for WrestleMania 19. And before the SmackDown taping, where they were going to do the match, Angle had a conversation with Vince McMahon and basically begged and pleaded, let's just stick to the plan. I can get to Mania, I can give you that main event, and then I can go off and have my surgery. Let's just get to WrestleMania. And he convinced Vince McMahon to allow it. Now, if that were today, you know, they have the whole medical team and everything, that wouldn't happen. But Kurt was able to convince Vince McMahon to let him come to Mania and to let him perform in the WrestleMania main event. But we almost got a very different match. And the other thing people remember is the botched shooting star press where Brock almost broke his neck. Very, very scary. Especially a guy with that much mass coming right down on his head, right down on his face. I mean, that's very different than somebody who weighs 170 pounds coming down on their face. Brock wasn't even going to do the shooting star press. He did it a whole bunch of times. He used to do it in developmental all the time. He would hit it perfectly. It was so smooth. But he wasn't planning on, he hadn't used it on the main roster, and he wasn't planning on using it at WrestleMania either. It was Johnny Ace, John Laurinaitis, who went up to Brock and said, hey, big night. You know what you should do? You know what you should use as a finish? How about that shooting star? And Brock was unsure about it, but I think they put a crash pad in the ring. He practiced it. He was hitting it, no problem. And I think Jim Ross also encouraged him, yeah, go ahead and do it. You know, it's a big move on a big stage. That's why he did it. And I remember watching it going, he's too far away. I mean, there's been talk about the ropes were very slick from people's sweat. Brock was very tired. The reason he fucked the move up is because Kurt was too far. I mean, I could tell just when he went to walk up to the top rope. Kurt was 3/4 of the way across the ring. How could he not see that? How come Kurt didn't roll over? He was too far away. And he tried to stretch and make it, but man, that is one of the scariest moments in WrestleMania history. As it was, he got severely concussed, but he's lucky. He only got away with a concussion. And on Raw the next night, Austin was storyline fired. And Bill Goldberg debuted to build to a match on the next pay-per-view against The Rock. 16 years ago, on April 3rd, 2005, WrestleMania went Hollywood. I love the movie trailers with all the wrestlers leading up to the show. Great promotion. Undertaker as Dirty Harry and Triple H and Braveheart and all the other ones they did. Chris Jericho had no match planned for WrestleMania. And it was he, along with writer Brian Gewirtz, who came up with the Money in the Bank ladder match concept. Vince McMahon is the one who tweaked it to where the winner would carry the contract around in a briefcase for an entire year. That came from McMahon himself. And that first briefcase was won by Edge, who successfully cashed in the following year. Edge hated the concept of the match when it was first pitched to him. He didn't even want to be in it. He had to be talked into even being in the match. Got talked into it by Jericho and Kane. And one of the reasons is because he didn't want to be kind of pigeonholed as the ladder match guy. It's like, oh, we don't have anything better for Edge. Yeah, we'll just put him in another ladder match. So he had to be convinced, and I think it paid off pretty well for him. Shawn Michaels and Kurt Angle had one of the greatest WrestleMania matches of all time, and only practiced one spot in advance of the match. Otherwise, they pretty much called it on the fly. Bobby Heenan said that after the match was over, it was the greatest match he had ever seen. And if the brain says that it was the greatest, then who am I to argue? John Cena won his first world title from JBL, and Batista beat Triple H to win the World Heavyweight title in a main event that was originally going to be Randy Orton against Triple H. Randy Orton as a babyface. But they did Orton dirty after Triple H beat him for the belt the year before in the fall. And the people were far more into Big Dave as a babyface than they were Randy Orton. WrestleMania 22. The following year is, to date, the last one to be held in an arena. They have all been in giant stadiums and domes since then. Big Show won his first WrestleMania match. It took him until 2006 to win his very first WrestleMania match, tagging with Kane against Carlito and Chris Masters. Edge, very upset about not being in the main event against John Cena, wanted to do something big and memorable. And he did. Spearing Mick Foley through the ropes, down through a flaming table in their hardcore match. Mickie James won the women's title from Trish Stratus and got yelled at by Vince McMahon when she came through the curtain for using a very sexually explicit hand gesture during their match. Oh, I remember that. I think we all do. According to Bruce Pritchard and Court Bauer, who was writing for the company at that time, months before the show, Pritchard proposed the idea of a Shawn Michaels-Eddie Guerrero match at WrestleMania, which Vince McMahon loved. He seemed to be on board with the idea. He loved the idea of the way it was pitched is that they would draw parallels between their careers. So these two, you know, heartthrobs in their day, you know, coming up, and there were other parallels between their careers, maybe them being on the smaller side and having to work that much harder and scratch and claw their way to the top to become world champion. And Vince McMahon loved the idea of, you know, promoting the match with these parallels between their two careers. It was a match that had never been done before, so you can bill it as, you know, a first-time-ever match. And he was even inquiring, McMahon was inquiring and saying, hey, what kind of footage of Eddie outside of his WCW stuff do we have access to? Because they were probably thinking already about, you know, promo packages for a potential match. Sadly, Eddie passed away in November, and the backup plan was Shawn Michaels against Vince McMahon. Vince McMahon almost had a match himself on this show, not with Shawn Michaels, but with Bret Hart. Instead of years later, WrestleMania 27, I think that would have been a better match at WrestleMania 22, although it still wouldn't have been great. You got to remember, this was still years after Bret had the stroke. And once that happened, the Bret Hart of old went bye-bye. As far as in the ring, he was never going to be that guy again. But I find it hard to believe their match at WrestleMania 22 would have been much worse than what they put together at 26. I mean, they worked within the limitations of what they had at 26. You know, Bret couldn't take any shots to the head. He really couldn't take any major bumps. Vince was fucking old. I mean, he's in good shape, but he's old. Even then, he was old. You know, what could he do? But the pitch was made, and it looked like there was at least the possibility that that match actually could happen. You know, there was a conference call with the writers and Vince, and they got Bret on the phone. And again, Court Bauer told this story, and it sounded like Bret was at least open to the idea. He was a little on the fence about it, but he was at least open to it. And everybody in the room was like, holy shit, this sounds like it might be a possibility. We might be doing Bret Hart against Vince McMahon at WrestleMania. And then about a week later, Vince told them the match was off, and it had something to do with Bret's end. He couldn't remember exactly what it was. I'm just assuming here, maybe it had to do with his Lloyd's of London insurance. Who knows? Kurt Angle and The Undertaker, they wanted to work together on this show for the World Heavyweight title, and according to Angle, Undertaker was even open to the possibility of Kurt ending the streak. he would have laid down for Kurt Angle and the streak would have ended at WrestleMania 22, but Vince McMahon was adamantly against the idea. And instead, they had that fantastic match about a month or so before at No Way Out. Even though that really should have been a match at WrestleMania. I mean, you could have done the match without ending the streak. I don't understand this idea that, you know, he would be against the match because he didn't want to break the streak. You know, unless Vince had other ideas for why he didn't want to do the match. Maybe he just didn't want to put the belt on The Undertaker. That's the only thing I can think of. Because you could have done that match at WrestleMania and had Undertaker go over. I mean, Kurt ended up dropping the belt anyway in that triple threat match. Rey Mysterio won the championship. So, I mean, why not just do Undertaker and Kurt Angle? They have that classic match at WrestleMania instead. I mean, people remember the No Way Out match, but I feel like you really have to be like a hardcore fan to really remember. Some of these matches at WrestleMania, they just stand out more because it is WrestleMania. And it's a shame that match isn't remembered and talked about more than it is. In the way that some of the other matches that Kurt Angle had are talked about, or some of the other Undertaker, you know, WrestleMania matches are talked about. If they had just waited a month and a half, and did the match of Mania, put the belt on Undertaker. You don't want him to be the long-term champion? Fine, let him drop the belt a month or two later. What's the big deal? And apparently those two felt the same way. The triple threat match for the World Heavyweight title was Kurt Angle defending against Randy Orton and Rey Mysterio. Rey had won the Royal Rumble. They were doing the storyline where he was going to try to win the title for his good friend Eddie Guerrero. Randy Orton had told Rey Mysterio the month before, Eddie's in hell, when they were doing all that crap on TV. They did the best they could with the 9 minutes they had. I think it only went about 8 or 9 minutes. They had their time cut right before they were about to go out to the ring. And I think they were going to go double that, and the match only went less than 10 minutes. So it felt very short, because it was very short. For a world title match with three guys at WrestleMania, 9 minutes? It's not a long time. And John Cena beat Triple H in the main event. This was the match where CM Punk came to the ring dressed up as a 1930s gangster during John Cena's entrance. That's gangster, not gangsta. So technically, you can say that this was CM Punk's WrestleMania debut. WrestleMania 23 in 2007 had, up until The Rock came back years later, the biggest buy rate in Mania history, thanks to Vince McMahon and Donald Trump putting their hair up in a battle of the billionaires that, depending on different stories out there, either was going to see Trump pick Hulk Hogan as his surrogate and Vince McMahon would choose Big Show so that they can get the visual of Hogan slamming Big Show, which ended up not happening at WrestleMania. Funny enough, it did happen a few weeks after WrestleMania in a match in Memphis. It had nothing to do with WWE. It's kind of a one-time standalone event in Memphis they put together and sold tickets for. And in fact, you can find the video online. Hogan, you know, even with the bad back that he had at that point, slammed Big Show. And Big Show was not in the best physical shape. Big Show was probably at his physical worst in terms of his weight. And Hogan got him up and slammed him. And they could have had that kind of Andre moment recreated at WrestleMania in the same state where Hogan slammed Andre. I'm sure that's why they wanted to do it. It's kind of too bad it didn't work out. I think that would have been a cool moment. But it was not meant to be. It was not meant to be. So that was one idea. Trump picking Rey Mysterio was said to be another idea before Vince McMahon nixed it. He was wondering, why would Trump pick someone so small? It doesn't make any sense. So they went with Umaga and Bobby Lashley, or Bobby Lindsay, as Trump mistakenly called him. More than once, by the way. It wasn't just a one-time thing. He did it again when he appeared on Don Imus' radio show in New York to promote the match. Trump said that his guy is named Lindsay, who is a, quote, black gentleman who is the strongest guy I've ever seen. Vince McMahon got his head shaved that night. And to his credit, Trump took a stunner from Steve Austin after the match. A horrible stunner. It is up there with Linda McMahon as one of the worst of all time. But he did take a stunner. One of Trump's minions objected to him doing it in the back, and he just kind of shooed them away and ignored them after Vince McMahon told him that, oh, don't, the crowd's going to go nuts for it. As soon as he heard the crowd's going to go nuts for it, he was shooing his people away saying, eh, get out of here. I'll do it, no problem. And Austin gave him the stunner. Batista and The Undertaker were furious over their world title match being relegated to the middle of the show. So they went out and they stole it. They stole the show. They had a great match. It should have been the main event that night. Instead, it was John Cena defending the WWE title against Shawn Michaels. Shawn Michaels got that spot when Triple H tore his quad, his other quad, in January. They were preparing for a Triple H-John Cena rematch. I don't know what Shawn Michaels would have done. Maybe they would have worked him in there as a triple threat. I don't know, but Triple H was hurt. Shawn Michaels got his spot. And, you know, Michaels, he was said to be steaming mad with Cena when the match was over. He thought that John Cena did a very poor job of selling the leg. Michaels was working over Cena's leg, his knee, for a good part of, I'd say, the first half of the match, as I recall. And he just didn't think he did a good enough job of selling it later in the match. He took great issue with that. He was, you know, he even blew off Cena when the match was, you could tell something was wrong because when the match was over and they were showing replays, the replays ended and Cena had to leave the ring to go get Michaels to stop him from leaving. Because the reason he did that is because the plan was in the ring, Michaels and Cena would shake hands. It would almost be like an endorsement, like, okay, you got one over on me kind of thing. Michaels didn't shake his hand. Michaels went to go leave. And Cena, you know, remembered what they were supposed to do. He went out to go get Michaels and kind of turned him around. And you could just tell, just look at Shawn Michaels' face. I mean, he looked, that was more than him just kind of selling that he was upset about losing in storyline. So I can absolutely believe that he was not happy and he was supposed to shake hands with Cena. He never did. He just walked off. I thought their 55-minute Raw match from the UK a few weeks later, not that this was a bad match, but I thought that was a much better match. 13 years ago this week, WrestleMania 24, from Orlando, TNA planned to attack the show. Maybe attack is a bit of a strong word, but they were going to fly an airplane over the Citrus Bowl with a giant banner promoting Impact Wrestling Thursday nights on Spike TV. Somebody tipped off WWE about it. They were able to get the plan nixed. But TNA did park a truck outside the stadium with a screen on the side of it that was showing TNA matches outside the stadium. WWE tried to get Oscar De La Hoya for a tag team match, pitting him and Rey Mysterio against Floyd Mayweather and Shane McMahon, but De La Hoya opted against doing it. Mysterio then tore his bicep, and we were left with Big Show coming back. He was in probably the best shape of it, at least the best shape he had been in since his WCW days. He had dropped a ton of weight, and it was Big Show one-on-one against Floyd Mayweather. The angle that they shot at No Way Out with these two to set up the match was just masterfully done. A masterclass in how to shoot an angle like this to get people invested in wanting to see this match. Shawn Michaels beat Ric Flair in what was to have been Flair's retirement match. Oh, I can never say this with a straight face. What was supposed to be Flair's retirement match. Well, I guess it was. It was his WWE retirement match. Although if it were up to Flair, he would have already been back. But Vince McMahon wants him to stay true to his word. So he never did wrestle again in a WWE ring, although Flair, he went on to wrestle several more times. Undertaker beat Edge to win the World Heavyweight title, which featured the longest sprint down to the ring by Charles Robinson that I have ever seen. I love that video I saw once of somebody putting the Ultimate Warrior's music to his big run down to the ring. I think one ref got bumped, and so here he comes. It's the longest friggin' aisleway. Funny enough, longest aisleway until the next time they were in Orlando, which was WrestleMania 33. I guess it was the same building, was it not? I think it was. They might have renovated it, but I think it was probably the same stadium. Very long. It was something like 80 yards down to the ring at WrestleMania 33, so it was probably every bit of that here. But after the Undertaker's win, there was a pyro accident in the upper deck that led to 45 fans suffering at least minor injuries. Three of them had to go to the hospital to be treated for their injuries. Could have turned out a lot worse. Fast forward to April 3rd, 2011, WrestleMania 27. WWE wanted Brock Lesnar to be on that WrestleMania card for a match with The Undertaker. It would have been Streak versus UFC champion. Lesnar at that time was the UFC heavyweight champion, but then he lost the title to Cain Velasquez. That happened on the same night, UFC 121, that The Undertaker was in the crowd at the UFC show that night, being interviewed by Ariel Helwani when Lesnar walked right by him and Undertaker asked him, "You want to do it?" He was there for one reason. He was there to shoot an angle for a match at WrestleMania with Brock Lesnar, which UFC president Dana White had no idea they were there to do. And I think Undertaker kind of felt bad about it after the fact, because I think he had gotten him the tickets and Dana White knew nothing of this plan that Vince McMahon had hatched to try to get Brock in for. And Brock may have known too, but nobody clued in Dana White. Dana White said, "No, I'm not letting him out of his contract, and I'm not, or at least I'm not letting him while he's under contract to the UFC, even though he lost the title." No, the answer is no. He would not let Brock Lesnar do WrestleMania. And so Vince McMahon then, and Dana White has told this story before, Vince McMahon then pivoted when he realized, okay, we're not going to get Brock for WrestleMania. So the backup plan that Vince McMahon came up with was for a real fight between himself and Dana White. And he told Dana White, "We could do it at WrestleMania, or I could come to the UFC and we can do it in the Octagon." And Dana White has said, if he had agreed to this and lost, if he had lost to Vince McMahon, he said he would never be able to show his face again. Sting was considered, briefly, but he was considered for a match with The Undertaker that year, but he ultimately decided against it. He ended up signing another one of these little one-year rollover contracts with TNA, which he ended up doing several times. And instead, Undertaker wrestled Triple H. Edge retained his world title in the opener against Alberto Del Dipshit after he had won the Royal Rumble that year. And that would be Edge's last WrestleMania match for 9 years. Jerry Lawler finally got his elusive WrestleMania match, but it came, unfortunately, against Michael Cole in a match that Cole ultimately won when the decision was overturned. So in the record books, it is a Michael Cole victory over Jerry Lawler. The match was a complete abomination. Cole got so much offense. I mean, he got a comically absurd amount of offense in this match, and it went just way too fucking long. If it was something short and Lawler had, you know, maybe taken a few shots, but then basically kicked this guy's ass, you know, they had Austin in the ring as the referee, yeah, maybe it wouldn't have been so bad, but this was just a complete just embarrassment. And The Miz retained the WWE title over John Cena in the main event. Had no business being the main event. This match should not have been a WrestleMania main event. Miz suffered a concussion. His head bounced off the concrete at one point. The Rock got involved. He had returned to the company after an 8-year layoff or 7 years, whatever it was. He was the host of WrestleMania. I think this was the first time they did this whole host of WrestleMania shit. He was the host of WrestleMania. He got involved and basically gave Miz the assist. Miz ended up retaining the championship. Miz was really more just of a backdrop. It was about Rock and Cena. This was the beginning of the Roxina program. Miz was just a warm body in the mix. It almost didn't even matter who the champion was. And it was the next night on Raw that Rock and Cena shook hands and agreed to have a match 1 year later at WrestleMania 28. It was the earliest that a WrestleMania main event has ever been set up. And then began a streak of 7 straight WrestleManias that I had the pleasure of attending, all of which got progressively longer each year until I just swore off attending any other WrestleManias until they either come back to Las Vegas or New Orleans. They come back to New Orleans or Las Vegas, I'm there. Because those are fun cities to hang out in. Otherwise, I just can't do it. But WrestleMania 28 in Miami, that was on April 1st, 2012. Once in a lifetime. Until, of course, it happened again the following year. Then it became twice in a lifetime. Rock and Cena. It did do WWE's biggest buy rate of all time. 1.2 million pay-per-view buys. Sheamus, in the opening match, beat Daniel Bryan in 18 seconds to win the World Heavyweight title, which Sheamus knew. He knew. It was going to turn the fans against him, which it did. Oh, let me tell you something. In the building in Miami the next night on Raw, those people, they hated him. They hated Sheamus. But what it did was it kicked off the Yes Movement. It was electric in that building the next night. Daniel Bryan wasn't even on the show the next night. He was in the post-show dark match. And it was the first time I had ever seen, and I had, it was so cool being in the crowd for it. It was the first time that you had the entire building of people doing the Yes thing, putting their fingers in the air, going up and down. Now it's commonplace. It happens every week. It's part of his shtick. It's been happening for years. That was the first time I saw that. That was the first time I was able to be a part of it on Raw that next night. It was an amazing thing. So as ridiculous as it was for him to drop the belt in 18 seconds, what it led to is something that I don't believe the company was banking on, but they, boy, did they get lucky. Because it was the first time the fans really started to get behind Daniel Bryan in a very big way. We had the end of an era Hell in a Cell match between The Undertaker and Triple H, with Shawn Michaels as the guest referee. The Rock beat John Cena in the main event as the only man who can claim WrestleMania wins over Hulk Hogan, Stone Cold Steve Austin, and John Cena. Nobody else can say that. The Rock has that on his resume. Those are three faces that you would expect to find on a lot of people's Mount Rushmore, maybe with The Rock himself. So that's a big deal. The next night on Raw is when Brock Lesnar made his return to the company for the first time in 8 years. 6 years ago, on March 29, 2015, WrestleMania 31, Sting has arrived. It is the match we never thought we would see. Sting wrestled his one and only WrestleMania match, and he lost to Triple H. Even Scott Hall and Hulk Hogan in the back, because remember they had the interference from DX, they had the interference from the NWO. Scott Hall and Hulk Hogan were there. They were in the back. And when Triple H gathered all the troops and he was laying out the match and how it's going to go. And he mentioned the fact that he, you know, Triple H was going to win. Scott Hall said that he just looked over at Hogan and Hogan looked at him like they couldn't believe it. They turned and looked at each other like, what the fuck? Now, Triple H has said that he won the match because they had plans in place for a match with him and The Rock in Dallas at WrestleMania the following year, which they did. And in fact, Triple H came back out again later in the show with Stephanie for a segment involving The Rock and Ronda Rousey. So he felt that Triple H had to win, especially if he was going to come back out later in the show and gloat and do some kind of segment with The Rock. But it doesn't change the fact that it was a ridiculous decision. I mean, first of all, why Triple H? How many people were clamoring of all the potential dream matches for Sting? Was Triple H really at the top of anyone's list? Like, I could see someone saying, yeah, you know what? I would have liked to have seen Triple H and Sting. Yes, but was that your number one match? If you made a top three WWE opponents that you wanted to see Sting in the ring with, would Triple H really be at the top of your list? Because if ever there was a year to do the match with The Undertaker, I mean, I guess they could have in 2011, Sting said no, but it would have been WrestleMania 31. For all of the different opportunities, you could say, oh, they could have done it here, they could have done it there. WrestleMania 31 would have been the time to do it. And the thing about that is Sting probably would have lost that match too. So it's just a matter of, you know, who do you want to see him in the ring with? I didn't really care to see him in the ring with Triple H. The fact that Triple H won was just even more ridiculous. But if he were in there with The Undertaker, I could almost excuse the loss because at least you're giving people the match that they wanted to see. I was always partial to doing a double retirement match. That's what I was always partial to, and it's the idea that I had pitched. You want to really put something on the line. You want to make this match really something special. Undertaker, at that point, he was already, you know, long in the tooth. I mean, he went a few more years, but you could have done a match where Undertaker puts his career on the line, Sting puts his career on the line. You know, going into that match, this is it. This is going to be the last match for two of the biggest names in wrestling in the last 25 years. One man has to win, one man has to lose. Someone's retiring a winner, someone's retiring a loser. A double retirement match. You want a real hook for WrestleMania? There you go. But Undertaker wasn't ready to hang it up anyway. Doesn't mean you still couldn't have done the match, but I guess Sting would have lost that too. So what do you do? Do you put Sting in the ring with Dolph Ziggler just to give him a win? I mean, what do you do in that situation? Who else would have made sense to put him in the ring with? And very late in the show, in fact, it was during that segment I mentioned with Rock and Triple H and Ronda Rousey and Stephanie. While that segment was going on in the ring, the decision was made behind the scenes to change the finish of the main event, which originally was going to be a Roman Reigns title win over Brock Lesnar. And instead, they kind of they went and got Seth Rollins, who had already lost to Randy Orton earlier in the night, that great elevated RKO spot, one of the best RKOs he's ever done. They went and found Rollins, and they got Rollins in a room with Reigns, Lesnar, and Heyman, and I'm sure Vince McMahon and Michael Hayes, to go over what the new finish was going to be, which was going to be a Money in the Bank cash-in and title win for Seth Rollins. First ever Money in the Bank cash-in at a WrestleMania. Reportedly, this did not go over too well with Roman's father, Sika, because Roman's family was there that night. They probably, either they were told by Roman, or they just assumed that he was going to win the title, and when that didn't happen, there were a lot of reports that some of the Samoan family members, Sika in particular, not very happy, very vocal about how unhappy they were at how things went. But hey, plans change. Shit happens. It was the right call to make. It is one of the greatest finishes to a WrestleMania of all time. It really was a great little swerve there in a great moment, the Rollins cash-in. And I would say it's got to be the first or second best Money in the Bank cash-in they've ever done. I struggle with it because I was in the building when Dolph Ziggler cashed in on Raw the night after WrestleMania 29. The building in New Jersey was literally shaking. People were so ready to see him cash in and win. It was a very pro-Ziggler crowd. A lot of people were pissed they didn't get it at WrestleMania the day before. So when he won, it was this explosion. It was such a cool moment. But the Rollins moment is just a far bigger moment because it was the WrestleMania main event. So in terms of the bigger cash-in, it doesn't really get any bigger than the Rollins one. But those are the two best ones. I mean, those are my two favorites, you know, bar none. 5 years ago, this week, WrestleMania 32, the largest attendance in WrestleMania history. They claimed 101,000 for the show, which Vince McMahon, on an investor's call when he was questioned about it, said that that number included everybody from ticket takers to ushers to WWE backstage staff, not just the fans. They lumped every human being in the building that night. And they came to that 101,000 number, which I'm sure is still a little bit embellished. But it was still a big crowd. It was something. Being in the stadium that night, looking around, it's just, you know, when you're in those big stadiums like that or those big domes, and there's that many people, you know, packed in, which, I mean, given what we're all going through now and the fact that there are no fans at any of these weekly shows, it's amazing to think back to being in the building with that many people at one time. But it really is just, it's overwhelming when you look out at that friggin' crowd. And I mean, anybody who's been to a college football game would probably say the same thing. They routinely get 100,000 plus people into those stadiums for those games. It really is an experience. It really is. But I'm sure they're going to try to top that number next year, if they can, if they're allowed to, when they return to Dallas for WrestleMania 38. Dean Ambrose says that he was met with laziness by Brock Lesnar in their street fight. He proposed several ideas, several crazy ideas, that Lesnar was not receptive to. And then a few months later, Brock Lesnar announced that he was coming back to UFC 200. So maybe he knew something that he didn't tell people about, and he just wanted to play it safe for his WrestleMania match instead of getting involved with all kinds of weapons and stuff. The butterfly belt bit the dust, and Charlotte Flair became the first WWE, or I should say not the first, because they used to have a women's title. I guess this lineage of the belt, she would be the first. But she became the new WWE Women's Champion with a win over Sasha Banks and Becky Lynch. Shane McMahon returned after a 7-year absence for a Hell in a Cell match with The Undertaker. And never forget that Eric Rowan had a match with The Rock at WrestleMania. Now, it only lasted 6 seconds, but as I told my last girlfriend, it still counts. In 2017, WrestleMania 33 was back in Orlando, and I can attest this was the best stage and set that WrestleMania has ever had. They paid $5 million for this very elaborate stage with this giant globe and a mock roller coaster. It looked phenomenal. Beautiful. It was fucking gorgeous in person. So I give them all the credit for that. Nobody does that better than WWE. The Hardy Boys made their big return to the company 24 hours after wrestling the Young Bucks in a match for Ring of Honor and blew the roof off the place, came out, ended up winning the Raw Tag Team titles in this big ladder match. John Cena proposed after his match to Nikki Bella, which didn't work out too well. Brock Lesnar beat Bill Goldberg in a fun match to avenge their horrible match at WrestleMania 20 and win back the Universal title. And Roman Reigns beat The Undertaker in a terrible main event. Undertaker, in his own words, looked like bloated Elvis. He had no business being in the ring that night. He knew it. It was very sad. It was sad to watch him in that state. You know, he was botching some moves there towards the end. But when the match was over, they had what really would have been the perfect send-off for the Undertaker character. And what everybody in the building thought was. We all thought that we were watching this man's retirement. This show went on forever. Right? And so when The Undertaker is in the ring after the match and he's taking off the jacket and he's taking off the gloves, it's 12:15 in the morning. And everybody is watching this. There are people in the crowd, grown men in tears, because they think they're watching the end of The Undertaker. It's this very emotional thing for them, apparently. But it was such a great moment. And then for him to go halfway up the ramp, he gets lower down to the gates of hell. Smoke comes out of the hole, the lights go out, the bell tolls. That, with Undertaker disappearing into a plume of smoke, would have been, for that character, the perfect send-off. But he just couldn't help himself. And he was right back the following year. And on April 4th, 2020, WrestleMania 36, 1 year ago, set a lot of firsts. A lot of firsts were made last year. It was the first WrestleMania to feature no fans in the audience. The first WrestleMania to be taped and not air live. It was taped over a week in advance from an empty performance center. Now, there may have been matches that were taped and inserted into the show. I mentioned the Hollywood Backlot Brawl, some of that cinematic stuff. WrestleMania itself is always a live event. And that was not the case last year. Over a week in advance, it was taped. And it was the first WrestleMania to stretch across two nights instead of one, following the lead of Wrestle Kingdom and what New Japan had done with its big show. At one point, The Fiend, Bray Wyatt, was to have defended the Universal title against Roman Reigns until Bill Goldberg fucked it all up and handed The Fiend his first loss in Saudi Arabia and took the championship. That was to set up a match with Goldberg and Roman Reigns until Roman Reigns pulled out due to COVID concerns, as he is a leukemia survivor. And we ended up with Braun Strowman beating Goldberg to win the belt. Edge wrestled his first singles match in 9 years against Randy Orton. Last Man Standing, a match that might have played better in front of an audience, but it just went far too long. It bored me to tears. Drew McIntyre won the WWE title from Brock Lesnar. I don't even know that both title matches on this show combined went longer than 5 or 6 minutes, which has to be a first. And we had two cinematic matches, a Boneyard match between The Undertaker and AJ Styles, which was the match of the WrestleMania weekend. It was the best, most enjoyable match, I thought. Most creative, unique match, certainly. Most enjoyable of WrestleMania weekend. And we had a Firefly Funhouse match between John Cena and Bray Wyatt, which was not, although it was unique in its own way. I liked elements of it, other aspects of it not so much. I don't know if we're going to get another one this year. Apparently not. I guess there's only 1 week left until WrestleMania. They haven't announced a stipulation yet for The Fiend and Randy Orton. There's still time. But that was 1 year ago. And even though we're still in the middle of this pandemic mess, we are going to have fans at WrestleMania. We're not going to have fans back at the live weekly shows. After WrestleMania, it's going to be right back to the Thunderdome. But at WrestleMania, we're actually going to have flesh and blood people. 25,000 plus people in the crowd on both nights of WrestleMania, spread out all across Raymond James Stadium in Tampa. It will be nice to have fans in the stadium. It did not feel like WrestleMania. You can't have WrestleMania in an empty warehouse and expect it to feel like WrestleMania. And they were up against the wall. They had to just manage. They had to adapt. It wasn't their fault. But it wasn't WrestleMania. And so this year it'll be nice to have a show outdoors with people, even if it's fewer people. It will at least feel like a WrestleMania. And I look forward to that. And that is this week. This very busy week, I should just say, in WrestleMania history, is really what it was. Over 20 WrestleManias this week in history. Oh my goodness. I am ready to just crawl into bed now and sleep for 15 hours. But you know what? It was a lot of fun going down memory lane. I hope you enjoyed it. There are a bunch of other WrestleManias as well that are coming up this upcoming week in history. And then we can finally close the book on WrestleMania. And so we'll get into those events next week. But I do hope you enjoyed this trip down memory lane, and maybe you heard some stories and learned a few things that you didn't know about before. I hope you enjoyed this bonus episode of The Sound Off. If you missed episode 698 earlier today, the main podcast dropped. We got a lot of news to cover on New Japan, Chris Jericho showing up on the Broken Skull Sessions, NXT's move to Tuesday nights, Andrade shooting on various subjects and telling people why Charlotte Flair was pulled from WrestleMania, the Hurt Business being broken up. A lot of stuff. A lot of good, bad, and ugly stuff to get into. So if you missed it, go back, check out episode 698, tweet me, email me, leave me your feedback. We got a busy week coming up of WrestleMania content, AEW Dynamite Live review after the show on Wednesday. We're going to review both nights of NXT TakeOver on Thursday, live on YouTube. Friday night, we'll talk about SmackDown and WrestleMania predictions. And then both nights of WrestleMania, Saturday and Sunday, night one, night two, join me live on YouTube. I'm going to be there covering all of it. And I hope you will be part of it with me. Until then, be well, stay safe, And I will see you guys at some point this week for all of the new content coming up, and then $6.99 next weekend, and more this week in history. Until then, take care, guys.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
Oh, we were told by Triple H that night 2 years ago. They're going to give the fans what they want. You are the authority. And everybody cheered, yay! Because 2 years later, and things are no better off now than they were then. They're worse. Absolutely nothing will change in this company until one thing happens, and one thing only. Vince McMahon must resign as the lead creative force in World Wrestling Entertainment.
The Sala Monster sounds off. Available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesalamonster for sound off extras and more. And follow the Sala Monster on Twitter @SalaMonster.
Sala Monster.
Sala Monster.
Put that cigarette out.
Sala Monster sounds off.